It's the NPR News Update on this tax day, Monday, April 15th. I'm Phil Picardi, and here's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Today, we look at the effort at the state capitol to regulate dog and cat breeders. We hear from a young Minnesotan who's looking forward to full implementation of the health care overhaul. And those long-locked-out American crystal sugar workers will get their keys back. State lawmakers are expected to begin taking votes on a slate of budget bills this week. Lawmakers have until mid-May to finish their work. For 6 years, animal welfare advocates have been pushing a bill at the state capitol that would regulate dog and cat breeders. They say in the age of the internet, it's too easy for unscrupulous breeders to peddle animals online, and buyers never see the conditions where the animals are raised. Animal breeders say Minnesota already has animal cruelty laws in place, and good breeders should not be punished. Reporter Sasha Aslanian looks at the difficult politics of regulating dogs and cats.
Nancy Minion is an animal lover who remembers the exact moment, 24 years ago, that brought her to the state capitol.
I was just sitting on the couch watching TV one night, and I saw a story of a dog that was beaten, blind, and deaf. And I just went, all right, that's it.
Minion successfully pushed for a law to seize animals from people convicted of animal cruelty. In 2001, she helped pass a felony animal cruelty law. And in 2004, she helped get tigers, monkeys, and bears banned as pets. For the past 6 years, she's been focused on dog and cat breeders. They're unregulated by the state. Breeders who sell to pet stores have to abide by federal USDA regulations, but that's only a very small number. And there's a patchwork of local ordinances that mostly cap the number of animals you can have. Now Minion wants the legislature to pass a bill that would license operations with 10 or more breeding animals that produce 5 or more litters a year. Licenses would cost $10 per animal up to a maximum of $250 a year. Breeding facilities would also be subject to annual inspections from the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. Minion says that's necessary because animal cruelty laws are only triggered if someone makes a complaint and unscrupulous breeders don't let you see their operations.
They don't want you in their barns and sheds and, you know, so they'll meet you at a truck stop or a weigh station or a parking lot, show you, you know, 5 or 6 puppies or kittens, and you pick and then you leave. But you don't see any suffering.
But Minion keeps track of the suffering. She has binders of photographs of animals rescued in Minnesota. Photographs show fur matted with urine and feces, animals whose eyes were so infected they had to be removed, animals fed roadkill or emaciated.
This is a toy poodle, and there was a breeder in St. Paul who had these dogs in his basement breeding to sell the puppies. And as you can see from her, her back legs are all deformed and her spine, she can't walk on her back legs because she was kept in a carrier so small that she couldn't develop. If this bill were law, this person would have been inspected and they would not have been licensed.
I find the saddest things that they can, and they're trying to get to people's heartstrings by showing those, and not everybody is like that.
Belinda Donnelly is rankled by what she sees as a perception that people who make their living breeding dogs and cats don't care about their animals. Donnelly is president of the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association. She raises miniature schnauzers, Cairn Terriers, and Westies.
I'm not going to tell you how many dogs I have, but I will tell you that the minute that I tell somebody that I raise 3 different breeds, I bet you probably every 3rd phone call I get, you're not a puppy mill, are you? And I say, no, I'm not. I'm an educated breeder. I consider myself a professional in this field.
Donnelly says reputable breeders want the bad operators to get out of the business, and some kind of regulation is needed. But Donnelly says pet breeders are tired of playing defense against the bill Minion and her coalition are pushing.
We have been back and forth with these animal rights people for the last 6 years, and 5 of which we spent our own money and our own time down at the Capitol many, many times. There are some areas of that bill that are too lenient, and then some of it that's too harsh.
Members, this has been a 6-year saga that we have worked on this bill.
Representative Lesh, before we begin, you want to move your bill?
In February, the lead sponsor in the House, John Lesh, a DFLer from St. Paul, reintroduced the pet breeder bill to the Civil Law Committee, which he chairs.
We have made a lot of compromises on this bill.
Lesch's bill picked up an endorsement from Governor Mark Dayton and passed three committees before it hit the one in March, where it dies every year, the Ag Committee. Representative Tim Faust, a DFLer from Hinckley, is vice chair of the Ag Policy Committee. Faust says what troubles him about the Lesch bill is the growth of government. The Board of Animal Health would need to hire 5.5 more inspectors, and it would cost the state about $500,000. Faust also feels it would penalize breeders who are doing a good job. He was looking for a different solution. So were lobbyists hired by the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association and the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. Faust says the lobbyists came to meet with him.
And they said, we would really like to offer our own bill. We, in the past, we've just tried to kill that bill, but now we actually think it's time to write our own bill, a competing bill, and that they thought was a much better option. And so that's how it ended up being introduced.
The bill Faust is sponsoring wouldn't require licensing. And instead of routine inspections from the Board of Animal Health, Faust would like to see veterinarians sign off on pet breeders.
The veterinarians are going there anyway, especially for the larger breeders. I mean, you've got animals are getting sick all the time, and so the veterinarians are out there all the time. And I believe that the veterinarian is the one that is better qualified to make the call whether or not the dog breeders are living up to what they should be doing.
Faust thinks pet buyers would help police the system by asking to see a pet breeder's certificate of veterinary inspection before buying a puppy or kitten. And he doesn't think it's a conflict of interest for breeders to select and pay the vets who inspect them. Representative Lesch disagrees. Neither bill's gotten a hearing before the House or Senate Ag Committees, but Lesch says he's feeling optimistic about a breakthrough on what's now become a perennial issue at the Capitol.
It's ironic, but sometimes it takes 6 years for people to really understand the bill. And for the bill's authors, me included, really trying to find the sweet spot where that legislation is going to work.
Both sides are trying to come up with a compromise, and if they do, the chair of the House Ag Policy Committee has promised to give it a hearing.
Sasha Aslanian on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Weakness in the nation's employment numbers for March could be a harbinger for Minnesota's jobs report. That's due out later this week. Annie Baxter has more on that.
The nation added a paltry 88,000 jobs in March. That was far fewer than expected. Economists link the weakness to across-the-board federal spending cuts known as sequestration. A bump in payroll taxes may also play a role in the weak employment growth. If consumers have less money to spend, they may patronize fewer businesses, who in turn hire fewer workers. Steve Hine, Minnesota's chief labor market analyst, says Minnesota's job growth has been strong over the past 6 months, outpacing the nation's. But he's not sure how long that can last.
The weakness in March's national numbers, have to be a bit concerning as we start to look at what happened in the state over the same time period.
That said, Hine says unemployment insurance claims and job openings in Minnesota are at levels reflecting a solid economic recovery.
Annie Baxter on business. Well, as you know, the business of health care is changing big time. And for some, the federal health care laws changes can't come soon enough. Elizabeth Stawicki has this profile of a woman who's losing her health coverage in June, leaving her in insurance limbo until the law takes effect in January.
Meet Laura Haynes of Minneapolis. She's 25 and has health insurance for a few more months. Under the federal health care law, she can stay on her parents' health plan until she turns 26 in June. Then she's on her own. She sees both a strong no argument and a strong yes argument for buying health insurance then.
I know how easy it is to have an accident or get really sick or just have something go wrong, and to be stuck with that kind of bill would be insurmountable for me. No, because I'm young and healthy, I exercise, I eat well.
It's not clear how many people are in the same situation as Laura Haynes, but researchers indicate they could number in the hundreds of thousands nationwide. Haynes has had trouble finding full-time work with benefits, like many young adults trying to find work in the aftermath of one of the worst recessions in U.S. history. She graduated in 2009 with a degree in mathematics and women's studies and has cobbled together part-time jobs at nonprofits, jobs which provide career experience but not health insurance. Haynes has done some shopping for health plans.
And I've found some right now that are seemingly affordable, but then their deductible is so high that it's almost like I would still have to pay so much that it wouldn't be worth it for me to have that insurance.
Some plans had just a $100 monthly premium, but an annual deductible of $10,000. Haynes has another option, but that too is far from perfect. She could enroll in MinnesotaCare, the state's subsidized health plan. MinnesotaCare is for people under age 65 who earn too much to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough to afford commercial health insurance. MinnesotaCare would be affordable for Haynes with a monthly premium of less than $50, but it won't cover her in June. MinnesotaCare has a four-month waiting period, so the earliest she could access it would be October. And then, if she needs to be hospitalized, MinnesotaCare would pay bills only up to $10,000. Governor Dayton has proposed eliminating those restrictions, and a key lawmaker says the legislature will probably do so. Lucinda Jessen is Dayton's Human Services Commissioner.
Starting in January 2014, there is no more $10,000 hospital cap for MinnesotaCare. And starting in January 1, 2014, the four-month waiting period goes away altogether.
All the change that's in the works makes an already complex system more difficult to navigate, even for people who do it for a living. Lee Grauman is an outreach worker at the nonprofit Portico Health Net in St. Paul, which helps uninsured people find coverage.
We're hearing so much about 2014 and health reform, and it's very exciting. I'm very excited about it. But there are still so many little details that need to be figured out. And until then, we just have all of these questions, and it's hard to find really concrete answers.
One of those questions is what the health plans on MinSure will cost. MinSure is the state-run online marketplace where Minnesotans will be able to compare side-by-side what health plans will cover and cost. But MinSure won't be up and running until October, and coverage won't kick in until January 1st. The whole situation leaves Laura Haynes adrift in uncertainty.
If I at least have more information about it and can feel more prepared, I think I could make a better decision for myself. I'd like to know about what the costs are looking like. That's really the biggest thing, is what are the costs? I'd like to know what are the subsidies.
The MinSure website does have a calculator where individuals and small groups can get a sense of what their subsidies and costs may look like. It says Laura Haynes could expect to pay $48 a month for health coverage. That's affordable, but is it a reliable number? Those estimates are based on projections from the Congressional Budget Office that are about a year old. And even if it is, depending on her income, state rules may require her to get insurance through MinnesotaCare anyway.
That's Elizabeth Stawicki on the NPR News Update. Don't you hate this weather? Spring is passing in a winter torpor and we'll never get it back. It's still snowing in parts of northern Minnesota, where a weekend storm dumped a number of inches of new snow. And they're still cleaning up after last week's ice storm in southwestern Minnesota. The fourth season for the Nice Ride bike rental program in the Twin Cities is back on track after the weekend snow temporarily shut it down. Nice Ride Executive Director Bill Dossett says customers could return bikes during the storm, but they couldn't rent them. He says the measure was taken to keep riders safe and protect the bicycles. Dossett says Nice Ride customers will eventually be able to rent bikes from new locations. He says the program is adding 24 new stations to the network this year.
You're going to see stations in places along the river, because the National Park Service, through the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area, has been a major supporter of this program, creating more access to the river through alternate transportation.
Dossett says last year, Nice Ride registered 275,000 user trips, the most to date. Locked-out American Crystal Sugar Union members are headed back to work. The union voted over the weekend to accept the company's contract offer. Union members have been locked out at five factories in the Red River Valley since August of 2011. As Dan Gunderson reports, workers expect a bumpy return to their old jobs.
Just enough union members changed their votes to ratify the same contract they had rejected four times. The new contract means more money for workers. However, they will pay more for health insurance, and union officials say they'll lose some job security. The union says 55% of workers who voted agreed to accept the company's contract offer. Dennis Gerlach is one of the workers who changed his vote to yes.
It's money, it's family life, it's how do I start over again in another career or in another job. I'm not ready to retire yet, but I'm not ready to, start over.
The 56-year-old Gerlach worked 35 years at the Moorhead factory before the lockout. After the lockout, he accepted another job for less money. He says he's happy to be going back to work, but he won't have the same trust in American Crystal leadership. Gerlach says the company spent months planning to lock out employees.
I think they have to actually do more time in planning than that to build relations among everybody again. I really wonder if they're qualified and if they are going to do that, but we'll see.
Frustration is the emotion 52-year-old Gail Lund feels as she prepares to return to a job she held for 23 years before the lockout. Lund voted no for the fifth time because she says the company refused to negotiate the contract. But she will go back to work. She says she needs the health insurance. Lund says she'll be going back to a very different workplace.
And with a lot of different people. People who have been doing my job. And yeah, that burns a little. I think it's going to be a big mess for a while.
Returning union workers will get their old jobs back, but they'll be working alongside the workers who replaced them during the lockout. American Crystal says roughly half, at least 650 of the union workers, retired or quit during the lockout. Union members and replacement workers can apply for those open positions. Lund fears it will be a tense workplace, and as a union member, she'll have a target on her back.
In our return to work agreement says absolutely no harassment will be tolerated. Now, I'm assuming they mean us harassing the replacement workers, but, you know, maybe someone doesn't like me and decides, well, I'm going to get her out of here and make up some story and I'm gone. I don't know.
The union says with the lockout over, replacement workers at Minnesota factories must now join the union. Workers in North Dakota can't be forced to join a union. American Crystal Sugar Vice President Brian Inglesrud says union workers should be back on the job in about 6 weeks. Inglesrud says integrating the returning union workers and replacement workers will be a challenge. He says the transition will take time. He says the company will expect all of the workers to treat each other with respect.
I think the good thing is that we have a very good relationship with our current workforce, the replacement employees. And they're going to make up a very large percentage of our workforce going forward. My hope is that the culture that's been created with that group of employees will carry over.
Inglesrud says last year's sugar beet harvest will be processed and the factories will be shutting down for the summer by the time the union workers return, so they'll have a few months to integrate the workforce. The company will hold employee meetings over the next 2 weeks to determine how many union members want to return to work.
Dan Gunderson is based in northern Minnesota, so we stay with him for news about Minnesota Power holding public meetings over the next 2 weeks. Dan says company officials want to talk about a proposed high-voltage power line across northern Minnesota.
The 500-kilovolt line would run from the northwest corner of the state to Hermantown. It would carry power generated by hydroelectric plants in Manitoba. Minnesota Power Supervisor Jim Atkinson says it's very early in the permitting process for the line, but public input will help choose the best route.
It's first impact to people and trying to minimize that. And then we need to look at a whole litany of environmental considerations from wetlands and cultural resources, threatened and endangered species. In order to do that and really refine that, we need to meet with as many people as we can.
Atkinson says construction on the line is expected to start in 2017 and take 3 years to complete. He says the line will reduce the need for coal-generated electricity and help meet growing electricity demand on the Iron Range.
Dan Gunderson there in Moorhead. The Burnsville Police Department and Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension are investigating skeletal remains found in a park over the weekend. Rupa Shenoy reports.
Burnsville Sergeant Rory Bochniak says a man was walking his dog deep in the woods of the Murphy Hanrahan Park Reserve when he found human remains. Bochniak says, as yet, investigators know little about the remains.
However, we do have a missing person that we were looking for last year. So it's possible it could be this person, but we won't know until Hennepin County Medical Examiner determines who this is. Examiner will have to determine if there's foul play, if any.
Bochniak says the man who wandered away from his home almost exactly a year ago was elderly and had trouble walking. He says police searched the park reserve but never found the man. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Finally, a story about a Twin Cities premiere over the weekend. Biblical texts set to music are a church tradition. But when you add the element of jazz, it expands its artistic reach. Minneapolis composer and pianist Jeremy Walker has written a jazz choral piece based on the Book of Psalms that was motivated by his own struggle with illness. Seven Psalms premiered Saturday at Bethel University in Arden Hills. Chris Roberts reported for All Things Considered.
Jazz lovers know Jeremy Walker as the founder of Brilliant Corners, the diminutive yet dynamic downtown St. Paul jazz club where Itzhak Perlman and Wynton Marsalis once jammed into the night. Walker was also a gifted saxophonist with a brilliant career ahead when a mysterious autoimmune disease invaded his body. The agonizing illness wreaked havoc on his coordination. It stymied doctors for 12 years until they finally figured out it was Lyme disease. Walker was powerless as he watched his skill slip away.
I was a player, you know. I wanted to be a great improviser, a virtuosic saxophonist, and I became increasingly less virtuosic as Lyme disease kind of took its toll.
Eventually, Walker was unable to command his instrument and switched to piano. He started looking for a new way to compose and became drawn to the idea of creating a jazz choral work. Walker searched for something in English or American poetry that he might set to music, but settled on a more familiar, more sacred text, the Old Testament's Book of Psalms.
I mean, the book is just dripping with human hope and suffering and kind of all of it intertwined. So it was blues material.
Many of the Psalms are believed to have been written by Israel's King David. They're essentially songs which give thanks, call out enemies, and praise or petition God. A whole category of Psalms falls into what's called the lament genre, and in their expression of doubt, despair, and suffering, call out to God for an answer or assistance. They had a special resonance with Walker and felt ripe for an interpretation.
And it just sort of occurred to me that it would be interesting to put the jazz vernacular harmonic universe with the Psalms. And kind of once it occurs to me, and if a sound attaches itself to it, then I'm stuck. I'm going to do it.
Lord, do not rebuke me in your
Seven Psalms features a jazz quartet of bass, drums, saxophone, and Walker on piano, accompanying a solo vocalist and 15-member choir. The human voice and singing are at the core of the work, partly because an important element of jazz is the call and response, which comes to it through African-American spirituals and gospel music.
So right away, the call and response between solo voice or between the band and the choir, those sounds I could hear.
Have mercy on me.
Walker chose the Psalms he felt were the most universal and contemporary. He started with 13, then whittled them down to 7. The first half of the piece is stormy and dark as the singer cries out in distress or wails like Mahalia Jackson.
My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? My God,
in the second half, the music calms down, almost as if to reflect a deeper understanding of God. There's a variety of influences in Seven Psalms, from Mozart's Requiem Mass and the chord progression to House of the Rising Sun to Johnny Cash's cover of the Trent Reznor song, Hurt. It contains melodic representations of the anguish and uncertainty of Walker's illness. It also reflects his Christian beliefs.
I'm devout but troubled, and I think that belief in anything, another person, friendships, whatever it is as much a crisis as it is comforting.
In Seven Psalms, Walker is exploring the crisis and comfort of the nature of faith. Chris Roberts, Minnesota Public Radio News, Arden Hills.
Restore.
That's Chris Roberts and a look at music that premiered over the weekend at Bethel University. I'm Phil Picardi, and this is the NPR News Update. Tuesday's news when you want it right here tomorrow.